Good day, everyone. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Lami is rocking the house.
That was a great MIA impression you had there, Rob.
Oh, was that not bad?
Right then, it's on.
And what was that that we were listening
to? That was
to?
MIA, much, much touted as the album of 2005. And that was track 12, You Are a Cutie.
And so are you, Lamia.
You too.
Thanks.
Full of love, 2005.
A lot of love in the Animal Voices studio today. I am your host today, Rob Moore, here with always lovely Lamia Gibson. Did you hear last week's show? We spoke with Jim Harris, leader of the Green Party of Canada, and their environment critic, Sharon Labchuk, about some of their policies, and specifically their animal protection plank, as written by Rebecca Aldworth. And I'd like to get some feedback from our Canadian listeners as to who you're going to vote for in the next election on January 23rd. I'd just like to gauge where we're at as a movement. Do you think the Greens are sincere in their promises, or are they like the other big parties that will just say anything to get into Parliament? Perhaps you don't even believe in the electoral process, but maybe you think that voting on their campaign at least will get the seal hunt and the animal cruelty bill to be part of the debate. So email us at animalvoices@ciut.fm and let us know your thoughts. We actually had an old forum up on our website, www.animalvoices.ca, several months ago, but we took it down because we had these grandiose plans of revamping the thing and integrating it with the main site. But, well, that hasn't actually happened. So maybe I'll put that back up, that old forum, if we can get the Canadian movement talking about politics. And we'll talk about this later with Eric. We're going to have Eric Marcus on the show today. We don't seem to be getting anywhere in Canada with what we've been doing. The animal cruelty bill hasn't been updated since 1892. The seal hunt has been reinstated to relatively little Canadian protest. Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like we've taken steps backward instead of forward. So I want Canadians to come together and start thinking beyond what we've been doing. And visit www.animalvoices.ca to listen to last week's show and all our other shows that we've got online as well. Okay, I'm off my soapbox. That's it. I'm done. Today we'll be speaking with author, activist, and podcaster Eric Marcus, in addition to writing Vegan, the New Ethics of Eating, and Meat Market, Animals, Ethics, and Money. Eric publishes the popular vegan.com website and hosts his own podcast called Eric's Diner. We'll discuss all of these, as well as Eric's novel proposal to build a dismantlement movement to complement the other animal protection movements with the ultimate goal of ending animal agriculture. So that should be a great chat. So on to the news. It seems that humans never cease in trying to tap the animal kingdom for resources. First from Yahoo News, scientists at a Georgia laboratory have developed what could be a low-tech, low-cost weapon in the war on terrorism, trained wasps. The tiny, non-stinging wasps can check for hidden explosives at airports and monitor for toxins in subway tunnels. You can rear them by the thousands, and you can train them within a matter of minutes, says Joe Lewis, a U.S. Agriculture Department entomologist. This is just the very tip of the iceberg of a very new resource. Lewis and others at the University of Georgia Tifton campus developed a handheld wasp hound to contain the wasps while they sniff out chemicals and other substances. Lewis and his partner, University of Georgia biological engineer Glenn Rains, say their device is ready for pilot tests and could be available for commercial use in 5 to 10 years. Rains says the wasps could one day be used instead of dogs to check for explosives in cargo containers coming into the nation's seaports, in vehicles crossing at border checkpoints, at airports, and anywhere else where security should be tight. Brain says the sensitivity of animals and insects to chemicals in general is probably beyond what we can comprehend. We don't really know what the limits are. Apparently not, according to this story from The Advertiser. The Russians have unveiled their latest weapon in the high-tech world of espionage, the tortoise. Moscow scientists have turned the slowest of reptiles into a bio-robot capable of penetrating secret sites with cameras attached to its shell. Typical targets would be a suspected nuclear facility under construction in a hostile country, new buildings at a naval port, or a remote military installation. The mission for Agent Tortoise would be to beam back ground-level images that would be impossible for a satellite-based spy camera to capture. in a series of experiments which might shock animal rights campaigners, the tortoises have emerged as superior to pigeons and rats, which also auditioned as spies. Pigeons turned out to be poor learners, and rats needed too much food, said Professor Alexei Burikov, who carried out the research at Rostov State University in southern Russia. The tortoise has many advantages by comparison. It can live without food and water for long periods and carry loads far exceeding its own weight. I guess that's bad news for the tortoise.
It's strange for the world.
Isn't that strange? It's bad news for humankind, I think.
I think so.
Now, I know that it can be difficult to be truly vegan. Animal products are one thing, but I'll read this next story not to emphasize that, but to merely say we really need to learn more about where our food comes from. The Independent out of the UK reported that endangered orangutans in Indonesian Borneo are suffering routine physical abuse when they stray into palm oil plantations, say wildlife groups and campaigners in the region. Poor migrant workers, often encouraged by the offer of extra pay from rainforest loggers, trap the animals and beat them to death. Wildlife rescue centers in Indonesia are overflowing with displaced and injured orangutans, many of which have suffered horrific injuries at the hands of their captors, says the Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation. In a particularly cruel killing, a male was buried alive, and in another, an orangutan was doused in petrol by rainforest loggers and set alight. Orangutans are particularly resilient animals and hard to kill, said Michel Desilet, director of BOS UK. Sometimes they are shot, but more often than not, they are killed with machetes or beaten to death. The global demand for palm oil, one of the world's most popular vegetable oils and used in products such as soap, chocolate, and lipstick, is encouraging the destruction of the orangutan. 90% of the world's palm oil comes from Malaysia and Indonesia, and most of the plantations are on the islands of Borneo and Sumatra. As rainforests are cleared to make way for plantations, the orangutans are forced out and are either killed or captured to be sold as pets. Campaigners say that Britain, the second biggest importer of palm oil in Europe after the Netherlands, and consumers should take a leading role in ensuring the product does not come from destructive sources. Next, from the New Zealand Herald, bird flu may be spread by using chicken dung as feed in fish farms, a practice now routine in Asia, the world's leading bird conservation organization believes. Fertilizing fish ponds with poultry feces, which can dramatically improve fish growth, may in fact set up major new reservoirs of avian influenza infection if the chickens providing the manure are infected themselves, according to BirdLife International. The suggestion, which has echoes of the BSE problem in Britain, in which cattle were infected by organic feed, is an explosive one on an international scale. It puts a serious question mark over a technique firmly backed by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization as a primary means of providing protein for mushrooming populations in the developing countries, suggesting that millions of people, instead of being helped by it, might ultimately die because of it in a global pandemic. Which is really no big surprise, since what we do to the environment, we do to ourselves, since we are a part of the environment. It's really the simplest of concepts, but we somehow have subtracted ourselves from the environmental equation, which is rather odd and ultimately dangerous. Known as integrated livestock fish farming, the technique involves transferring the wastes from raising pigs, ducks, or chickens directly to fish farms, with chicken or duck sheds sometimes sited directly over the fish ponds themselves. At the right dosage, the nutrients in the manure give an enormous boost to the growth of plankton in the ponds, which are the main food of fish, such as carp and tilapia. BirdLife International is now calling for an investigation into the possibility that these thousands of manure-fed ponds across Asia may be the means by which the new potentially deadly strain of avian influenza, H5N1, is being spread. BirdLife points out that outbreaks of H5N1 have occurred this last year at locations in China, Romania, and Croatia, where there are fish farms. And a nice story to end the news today. From CKNW in Vancouver, students at Greater Vancouver Secondary Schools will be receiving a new type of education in the new year, humane education. The Vancouver Humane Society also hopes this new program will reduce teen violence. The society is launching a program to teach youth about human oppression, animal exploitation, and the wearing and tearing on the ecological system. Bruce Passmore from the Vancouver Humane Society says this type of education has been proven to reduce violence within schools and the community. Statistically speaking, youth who are violent usually originate with violence towards animals, Passmore said. So this is a really important issue and a really timely issue for both of us here in Vancouver and for Canada as a nation. Passmore says when teens understand the consequences of their actions and are taught to feel more empathy for creatures around them, they tend to behave differently. The Vancouver Humane Society received a $35,000 grant from the Vancouver Foundation to launch the program. I think that's pretty good news. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to take a musical break, after which we'll be joined by activist, author, and podcaster Eric Marcus. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to CIUT 89.5 Animal Voices. Back to you, Rob.
Now we're going to be joined by Eric Marcus, author, activist, and podcaster. In addition to writing Vegan, The New Ethics of Eating, and Meat Market, Animals, Ethics, and Money, Eric publishes the popular vegan.com website and hosts his own podcast called Eric's Diner. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be on, Rob.
So we met at the Toronto Veg Fair back in September, and you were by the veg newsstand, I believe, and I heard your voice, which I recognized from your podcast. So, of course, I sauntered up and said hello. I wonder, do you get that a lot with people that will recognize your voice now that you're podcasting?
Yes, the funniest thing, I when I go out and do my various speaking events, it seems that nobody recognizes my face, but so many times people walk past me, hear my voice, turn around and say, "You're Eric Marcus."
Yeah.
And they've never seen a photo of me or whatever. So I'm definitely a lot more recognizable by my voice, for better or worse, than by my face.
Yes, it is a very distinctive voice. And why don't we talk about your podcast? We may be going in reverse order, but that's okay. It's my show. So what was your impetus for getting into podcasting?
You know, I was actually, Eric Steiner was one of the first 50 podcasts to start up. It started up right at the beginning back in October of 2004. And a friend of mine who was extraordinarily technically savvy just said, "Hey, this is something you really need to look into and find out about, because this would be a great opportunity for you to be reaching out into the vegan community." And this was a guy whose opinions about technology I really respected, and I figured, hey, this could be, you know, a pretty big thing that's starting up, and better to get in right at the very beginning. So within about a day or so, in fact, within 24 hours of hearing the word podcast for the first time, I very quickly decided that the audio software that I could get on my PC really wasn't up to snuff. So I went out and immediately bought an eMac just so I could do my podcast in GarageBand, which is this free software that comes with it. And, within 3 days after that, I did my first podcast. So it all happened very, very quickly. And now I'm doing the show once a week. And, it's really fantastic, because the response I get from people, the response I get from my listeners has just been extraordinary. I get emails all the time from people who tell me, because I've been listening to your podcast, it's really made veganism seem a whole lot more accessible to me. It's definitely gotten a lot more people on board as far as moving towards cruelty-free diets. And more than that, what's really exciting to me is that I think it's encouraged a lot more people to get into activism and to move on to doing bigger and bigger things within activism. And that, to me, is the most important thing that can happen. I mean, as somebody who's been vegan for years and years, I applaud the move, that the decision for anybody to say stop taking cream in their coffee. But as important as that is, it's a thousand times more important that people get out and adopt a college through vegan outreach, or take some of the other measures that really help to publicize vegetarian and vegan eating. In the United States, there are now 70 colleges, 70 different universities that have dropped battery cage eggs from their cafeteria menus. And that's all because of relatively small amounts of easy-to-do activism. And all it takes is people in local communities getting in on this task, and the next thing you know, you've got a cage-free egg dining hall. To me, you know, that's really the greatest thing that I aspire to with this podcast is to really help people find their ways into not just being vegan, but also taking up activism and understanding how easy it is to get involved in a really big way. You know, just today I got an email that the University of Iowa, of all places, right in the heart of animal agriculture, the University of Iowa is going to drop battery cage eggs from their dining halls in a pilot program. So things are starting to happen really quickly, and, you know, I just hope that my podcast is getting a few dozen or hopefully a few hundred people more and more motivated to taking up things like adopting a college or advocating for getting rid of battery cages from cafeterias.
Yeah, I guess you're right, because being vegan is, well, it's wonderful, it's incredible, but I guess when they're an activist, they become part of the snowball effect in making other people vegan and other activists as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, you can pretty much figure that if you become vegan when you're 20, you're really preventing about 2,000 animals from going to slaughter in your lifetime. And you can work very, very, very hard to try to remove that last 0.1% of animal products from your diet. You could become really, you know, obsessive about going to restaurants and grilling the waiter on every last ingredient in your food and so forth. And while animal products truly disgust me, and I don't ever want to have a molecule of those of animal products pass my lips, we have to realize that, you know, there's diminishing returns with what you can do through your own diet. And that, you know, the big thing is to just make an effort to get all the animal products out of your diet, and then rather than obsess and get a book like Animal Ingredients A to Z and really worry about the minutiae, really it is so much more important to move on to make sure that you're advocating effectively for animals. And that's really where you start getting at the big numbers. Not that 2,000 animals that you'll save in your lifetime through your diet isn't the big number, but you know, if you can get onto college campuses and persuade people to become vegan, you're talking about 2,000 animals for every person you get on board, and those numbers add up very quickly, particularly if you're doing things in a systematic way, like, you know, going out to the University of Toronto and adopting the college, handing out copies of Why Vegan. And I think that one of the things that has held our movement back for so many years, and one of the real reasons that the animal protection movement hasn't made the kind of progress that it needs to make, is because, by and large, we tend to be people who care immensely about animals but don't approach things in a systematic way. So, I mean, one of the things that I hope will come out of me being on this show today is maybe, just maybe, I will inspire one of your listeners or two or five to make a commitment to come out to University of Toronto for, you know, 1 or 2 days a month and pass out vegan outreach literature. There's really nothing you can do that really gets at the root of animal suffering and has the potential to keep so many animals from harm. And if you want information on adopting a college and doing this kind of work, just head on over to veganoutreach.org.
And also for those interested in listening to Eric's podcast, Eric's Diner, great title, by the way, you can log on to www.vegan.com and you can get all the information there. And actually, we've got a technically savvy person on our team as well, Neil Harvey, who got us into podcasting last year as well. So and us too, we've kind of exploded in the podcasting market. We get all these emails from people who've discovered us on podcasting. So it's great to have something like this technology to link activists together to one source and share ideas. Is through.
Hi, guys.
Oh, Lamia wants to mention something.
Well, actually, we just had a caller. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
And he didn't want to go on the air, so
okay.
I'm just going to pass on his comments. His name was Nathan, and he was saying, in addition to going vegan, that he's been vegan organic for 3 years. And he said, in addition to going vegan, to go organic because a few reasons. I mean, some we know, the chemical pesticides and fertilizers, if we keep eating them, it makes us sick. Then we have to go to the doctor and it costs more money in the healthcare system. By buying a lot of organic food, we will encourage the companies to drop their prices of organic food. It won't be so expensive, so on and so forth. And for some tips to make it affordable, he was saying he goes to Loblaws and buys the President's Choice organic line, and also goes to like the Dufferin Grove Market and the Riverdale Market, things like that. And then my quick response to him was, well, what about supporting Loblaws and Dominion and all those companies who are responsible for making things, or not, I mean, not specifically, but are a big player in the big corporations that make things not organic, and, I mean, it's an ongoing debate.
Yeah. Well, Nathan, thanks so much for calling in. I'm going to open the line to callers later, too, and you can ask Eric your activist questions. Eric, before we talk about the future, I want to look back and talk a little bit about meat market. You said there is great reason to be excited about recent advances made for farmed animals. Tell us what we have to be excited about.
Well, I think perhaps the main thing is that we're seeing very clearly that animal agriculture has tipped its hand about what it is most afraid of. Here in the United States, just about all of the major farm states, the majority of states in the United States, have enacted these laws called common farming exemptions. And the industry has gone through on a state-by-state basis and gotten their state legislatures to approve these just absurd laws that essentially say you can do anything you want to a farmed animal and not have to worry about facing cruelty charges so long as what you're doing is common throughout the industry. And think about what that means for a minute. That means that basically industry has given itself power to determine what is and what is not cruel. And they've been effective in getting these laws passed in all the big agriculture-producing states. Now, why is that so important? That's important because industry, it shows that industry realizes that the way they are treating animals today cannot be justified before the public. And in fact, an informed public who knows how animals are being treated won't put up with it. We've seen another instance of this, again in the United States, with the Animal Care Certified program that was initiated by the United Egg Producers. This was a program where for the last few years, every egg carton, essentially, in the United States has been stamped Animal Care Certified. Yet these eggs in each of these cartons were produced in the conventional way, that is, putting six or seven birds into a battery cage, searing the ends of their beaks off, just doing all the grotesque cruelties to these birds that your listeners are well aware of. And yet the egg industry, knowing that consumers were starting to learn about these cruelties, decided to essentially cover it up by stamping their eggs Animal Care Certified, this nice little check mark as though, hey, this is a concern, we're paying attention, we're going to make sure that these eggs in your hand are not produced through cruel means. But it was out-and-out deception. It was just as blatant of a lie as anything could be. And, in fact, the Better Business Bureau stepped in and said, hey, you guys should not be doing this. This is outright deception, and it should stop. But the Better Business Bureau lacked the power to get the egg industry to stop doing this, and they kept stamping their eggs Animal Care Certified. And it took until the last few months where the Federal Trade Commission had to step in and say, okay, look it, the Better Business Bureau may not have the power to stop this, but we do. And effective in 4 months from now, you need to make sure that no eggs come to market that are stamped Animal Care Certified, because this whole program of yours is deceptive. And, you know, when you see actions like this on the part of animal agriculture, the common farming exemption laws that have been passed throughout the states in the United States, when you see the Animal Care Certified program, that bogus marketing ploy by the egg producers, when you see stuff like this, it becomes really clear that animal agriculture knows that Americans and Canadians are not going to put up with cruelty if they are adequately informed.
So, yes, yeah, so it does show that the industry knows that people aren't going to stand for this kind of cruelty, and they don't want that kind of cruelty to be well known out there. So let's stamp things animal care certified. And without a major regulatory body, they can do whatever they want unless someone like Compassion Over Killing goes in and does these investigations, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, Compassion Over Killing and Mercy for Animals, those are only the first steps in the chain to exposing the suffering. Groups like that can get it into newspapers in Canada and the U.S. They can definitely do that. But, you know, it's up to people like me and you. It's up to your listeners to take this information and jump on it and make sure it's getting out to the general public. And that's one of the things that I think is so urgently important, because I think one of the reasons that the animal protection movement has really been losing ground to farmed animal agriculture over the last 30 years is that, by and large, vegetarians, vegans, activists, we don't tend to be as good about speaking about the issues as we need to be. And one of the things that I did in Meat Market, one of my main priorities in writing that book, was to evaluate our rhetoric and to really file away the rough edges and to put together a case against animal agriculture that could be made a lot more concisely and with far greater effect than the typical arguments that have been made by activists for the last 30 years. And I think that we are now really well positioned to make use of this kind of approach towards arguing that I talk about in my book. And it works out to be vastly more effective, I found, in winning people over and getting people to begin dropping animal products from their diets and even moving all the way to becoming totally vegan.
You've proposed this concept of dismantlement as a fourth movement in addition to the other movements. Could you talk about adding that movement into the animal protection community?
Sure. Well, what dismantlement is it is a systematic approach to going after animal agriculture where they are weakest. Any industry has assets. Any company has assets. You look at a company like Microsoft, and one of their assets is their operating system. Another asset is their office software suite. Another asset is their mouse and keyboard division. And not all of these assets are equal. Some are much bigger and much more important than others. In like manner, the industry of animal agriculture has many, many assets. And some of these assets are very important. Some of them are less important. But more importantly, some of these assets are quite vulnerable to activist intervention. And I think the biggest asset of animal agriculture is the fact that most Canadians, most Americans are able to get all the way through high school and then all the way through college without really being exposed to what is happening on factory farms. And we are, as a movement, we are now reaching the numbers that if we make a concerted effort to do things like adopt colleges and to do things like pass out the right information, and if we do things where we actually learn how to speak about these issues as persuasively as possible, we're going to very quickly strip away this one overarching asset of animal agriculture that allows it to perpetuate and grow stronger from one generation to the next. Now, I'm not under the illusion that all it takes is to talk to some 18-year-old about animal agriculture and they'll become vegan overnight. In fact, I think only a minority of people will make a total dietary change. But the important thing is that I think that year by year, we miss the majority of our opportunities to get young people to go vegan. Young people are just not hearing the message, not being exposed to the message, not receiving things like Why Vegan booklets, not watching videos like Peaceable Kingdom. We have not been putting enough energies, enough time, enough dedication into stripping away this critical asset of animal agriculture, which is the ability for people to get all the way into adulthood without ever coming to grips with what factory farming is all about.
So does the dismantlement, do you see like taking apart the industry itself and actually getting rid of factory farms and ultimately, you know, these organic free-range farms as well? Is that the goal to this movement?
I definitely think that animals can be raised with far less cruelty than they are in factory farms. To me, that doesn't make it right. But if somebody is going to insist on eating milk or eggs, I would much rather see those milk or eggs come from animals who aren't caged, who aren't in stalls. And Chapter 3 of Meat Market talks all about this and the fact that it is very, very difficult to remove all of the cruelties from animal agriculture, even if you make a good faith effort. The fact is that just like factory farm products, free range and organic products are still commodities, and all of the producers in that field are under financial pressure to cut costs as much as possible. And whenever you're working within that paradigm, the animals bear the brunt of these cost-cutting measures. You know, so I talk about in Meat Market the fact that it's essentially impossible to have cage-free or free-range eggs without killing every single one of the hens involved. It is impossible to create organic dairy products without killing each and every one of the cows involved. And for that matter, it's very hard to produce these products without even supposedly cruelty-free dairy products without generating a whole bunch of male calves, which, as you know, go straight to the veal industry. So I would like to see, you know, if I could snap my fingers and have animal agriculture disappear overnight, including the free-range producers, including the alternative producers, I would do it in a heartbeat. But there are many people out there who are just not ready, just not willing to drop all of their consumption of animal products. And for those people, I do think it's an important step forward for them to at least not be buying their animal products from factory farm systems.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're speaking with activist Eric Marcus. If you've got a question for Eric or a comment, you can give us a call at 416-946-7000. Eric, you talk about some of these welfare reforms, and you talked about these universities who have stopped buying eggs from caged hens. If the welfare movement hasn't resulted in fewer animals being consumed, in fact, more animals are being consumed now more than ever, why should we concentrate on these welfare reforms?
Well, I think that the issue here is it would be a mistake to put 100% of our energy into welfare reform. Clearly, welfare reform does not prevent killing of animals. It really doesn't even prevent the mistreatment of animals. It just gets rid of some of the most gratuitous cruelties. But having said that, if a tiny percentage of our effort can eliminate a tremendous amount of cruelty, then I think it's well worth our time. And in the case of just this past month, in fact, on vegan.com, I mentioned a university in the United States that has stopped purchasing battery cage eggs. And this university, I think, was going through something like 260,000 eggs a year. Now, by making this switch, which really only took maybe a few dozen hours on the part of some activists within this university to push for this change, they have essentially kept battery hens out of cages for, well, 260,000 eggs times 30 hours in a cage per each egg laid. You're talking about eliminating just centuries of hellish conditions on the part of the chickens that laid these eggs each year. So I think that any time that we can strip away an enormous amount of cruelty within animal agriculture and do this on fairly trivial amounts of effort on our part. I think that's a big win for the animals. And I have to think also that, you know, when you have 70 universities in the United States who've already gotten rid of caged eggs, there's going to be a ripple effect from that, and people are going to become more sensitive and more caring about abuses to farmed animals as a result of hearing things like, hey, our university isn't putting up with this level of cruelty anymore. It has gotten rid of these products. So I think do welfare victories produce animal liberation overnight? Of course not. But when we can invest tiny amounts of time to achieve enormous welfare victories, I think that's something that is something we simply have to do.
And you also outlined the limitations of the three movements, as you call them, the vegetarian movement, the animal rights movement, and the animal welfare movement, the limitations of each of those. And you talked about the limitations in the welfare movement. Could you talk about the vegetarian and the animal rights movements now?
Well, I think one of the problems with the vegetarian movement is that we've relied too long on a set of arguments that really, in the end, aren't all that persuasive. We put two-thirds of our emphasis typically in arguing for vegetarianism on health and the environment. And I don't have time right now to tell you the limitations of the health and environmental arguments, but let me just say that they are profound. There are certainly a few good health and environmental arguments we could be making on behalf of animals and should be making, but for us to be devoting two-thirds of our rhetoric to health and the environment, well, when you understand some of the limitations of these health and environmental arguments, you begin to understand why we have not been as persuasive as we need to be and why more people aren't becoming involved in vegetarianism. In terms of animal rights, as you know, is an incredibly broad endeavor. It involves not just farmed animals, but companion animals and circus animals and zoo animals and laboratory animals. Every animal that is being abused at the hands of humans, animal rights has something to say. And while I personally am deeply opposed to cruelty towards any animal, at the same time, it's very important, I think, to realize that the case against various forms of animal exploitation, say hunting versus factory farming, those cases are very different. Some of them are more difficult to make than the case against animal agriculture, and frankly, some of them are even weaker than the case against animal agriculture. And so I think that since farmed animals represent more than 98% of animals harmed at human hands in North America, there needs to be a movement whose rhetoric is specifically geared towards farmed animals and really does not say anything about the other forms of animal abuse. And by keeping our argument focused and narrow and confined specifically to farmed animal issues, we gain a position of strength because we can't be undercut in some of these other issues. Now, am I saying that we should never make animal rights arguments? Of course not. But I think that when we make animal rights arguments, we have to do so very carefully, and we have to make sure that our audience is adequately prepared to hear these issues at length. And the beauty of confining our arguments simply to farmed animals, to animal agriculture, is that it's possible to make a very simple, compelling, and airtight argument against farmed animal cruelty in the space of 10 or 15 minutes. And you can make this argument in a way that animal agriculture does not have a convincing retort to what you're saying. So from a rhetoric point of view, from a persuasiveness point of view, and really that's what we're all about anyway. I mean, isn't the whole point of animal protection to be winning people over? From a rhetoric point of view, I think that a dismantlement approach that focuses on farmed animal cruelty really produces the biggest bang for the buck, really has the potential to win the most people over and to prevent as much suffering as quickly as possible. again, I'm just sketching out the core reasons to move to this style of argument, and Meat Market is, of course, a book-length treatment that exposes the advantages to working within this kind of framework on behalf of farmed animals.
I do wonder if the animal protection movement, animal protection community, is already fragmented into these separate movements that I guess don't seem to be accomplishing much, and I say that with the highest regard for all these activists who are in the movement. Would a fourth movement, you know, based in dismantlement, would that just serve to further fragment us?
I'm not at all worried about that. To me, you can make a case that there's only one movement. There's the animal protection movement. You can make a case that there should only be three movements and that this dismantlement movement I'm talking about is extraneous. Or you can make a case that there should be four movements, the dismantlement movement being one of them. And frankly, I really don't care whether you think there should be one or three or four different movements. That to me is not really important at all. What is important is that in writing this book, I found that talking about these things in this way and presenting dismantlement as though it's a fourth movement, it lets you see the other work that's being done within animal protection. And I think it was the best way to show, okay, here's what we've done over the last 30 years, here's what's worked, here's what hasn't, and here's something we could do differently. And what I'm concerned with is not fragmentation, it is effectiveness. And as long as, the main points that I'm making within this book, the need to switch our rhetoric style, the need to go after animal agriculture and begin stripping away its key assets, as long as those main messages are understood, whether people doing this kind of work consider themselves in the dismantlement movement or the animal rights movement or the animal protection movement, that isn't at all important to me. The main thing is that we need a large and growing number of people who are committed to putting animal agriculture into decline by stripping away some of its core assets. And we won't have time to get into it in today's interview, but there are a number of core assets of animal agriculture that I think could be stripped away comparatively easily. And I really believe that within our lifetimes, animal agriculture could be put into an irreversible decline.
We have about 10 minutes. I do want you to give us an example of one thing that you do think that could be stripped away.
There are so many things, but one of the things, for example, is in the United States, we spend the majority of our money on the National School Lunch Program. I think something like 70% of that program's budget goes to buying animal products. Now, that is just, no matter how you cut it, that is just absolutely insane. And here's the thing. This is something that even if you are a parent and even if you personally eat meat three times a day, everybody knows that, 70% of what you spend your food dollar on should not be animal products. Even the world's most diehard carnivore will tell you that. And yet that's the money ratio that our tax dollars are feeding America's school kids. We're feeding them in that kind of ratio. It's something that is just indefensible and cannot be justified by industry. And I think that this is one of many examples that I bring up in Meat Market where an informed public would never put up with that kind of budgetary allocation towards animal products. Essentially, America's school lunch program is a national dumping ground for animal agriculture's excess capacity. And this is an asset that animal agriculture has that is quite important to the industry and yet supremely vulnerable because it just wouldn't stand up to any level of scrutiny. You know, it's not just going to be the vegans of the world who think this is absurd. Even America's core meat-eating, audience would still find this to be a complete sellout on the behalf of the U.S. government to industry interests. And that's the kind of thing that I think we need to look for in North America as we pursue a dismantlement agenda. We need to continually ask, okay, what are some of the assets that animal agriculture has that could be stripped away? You know, the last time I was, in fact, when I saw you up in Toronto a few months ago, I saw these billboards all around town. And, you know, as atrocious as America's advertising is for animal products, I have to say these billboards in Toronto topped anything I'd seen in the United States. And maybe you've seen them, too. They've shown milk being poured into a tooth as though drinking milk strengthens your teeth. They show milk being poured into a healthy-looking skeleton. You know, the implication being that, hey, if you want healthy teeth, if you want healthy bones, you have to drink milk. And, you know, that's a contention that is just not borne out by the scientific literature. It's of course, quite easy to construct a vegan diet that has abundant levels of calcium and promotes bone health in a really forceful way. It's quite possible to accomplish all that through a vegan diet, and it should not be difficult to agitate against industry for putting up deceptive ads like that. So I think that we as activists always need to be thinking about what are some of the assets of this industry that are not only important but vulnerable. What's the low-hanging fruit? And let's go after that.
Yeah, it's true. In Canada, we've got tons of milk advertising. In spite of all the health reports that say, of course, you know, the nations are the nations with the highest dairy intake seem to have the highest rates of osteoporosis, you know, all that notwithstanding, the advertising still seems to be taking over. And I really like what you said. I think it was in your book. You said you talked about it would be so great if the animal protection community had some kind of assessment body to say, okay, well, let's look at the successes, let's look at the downfalls, and let's try this to try to move forward. And in Canada, I can't really name any successes that we've really had that to point to. And I think that it would be great if Canada had something like that, as well as the whole animal protection community. I wonder if you have any advice for activists who are trying to get organized, either nationally or internationally, if you think it's possible that animal activists can organize themselves, maybe come to some kind of agreement. I want to know your thoughts on that kind of organization.
Well, let's do the easy and most effective stuff first. Let's do the stuff that really anybody could do and that produces huge amounts of gain for the animals with a minimal amount of training, with a minimal amount of work. This is a show that, you know, your show is being listened to by activists all over Canada and especially in the Toronto area. Well, you know, rather than talk about what could happen, let's make something happen. Let's go after something really easy, and let me right now call upon listeners of your show to really make a commitment to get out there and do the easiest type of activism possible to go after the number one asset of animal agriculture in Canada. What I spoke about earlier, the fact that it is quite easy to go all the way through college and to graduate college in Canada without being exposed to the message of factory farming. So as we get ready to close out this show, I just want to invite your listeners to head over to vegan.com and to click on the Contact Eric Marcus button on the top of the page and to just send me an email and say, hey, I want to get involved in adopting a college. If your listeners send me those emails, I will get them in touch with the people at Vegan Outreach. We'll get materials out to them, and we will play a part today in making sure that listeners of this show are stripping away one of the core assets of animal agriculture. Rob, I would be happy later on this week to let you know how many listeners get in touch with me and make a commitment to go out and do this. This is something anybody could do. It only needs maybe a couple of hours a month to really have an enormous effect. And, you know, I think if there are so many listeners of shows like mine and shows like yours that really just need to be asked to take that next step and to do something beyond just listening to a radio show, but actually to just get out there and start doing some of the easy and effective work that needs to be done on behalf of animals. So again, all it takes is just go to vegan.com, click the Contact Eric Marcus button, and write me a short email telling me where you are and how you would like to get involved in the Adopt a College program, and I'll put you in touch with the right people, and we'll get that information straight to you.
That sounds awesome. Let's make something happen. In 2006, let's make something happen. Sounds good to me. Eric, we've got about 1 minute left. Do you have any plans for this year?
Well, I'm going to tour. I suppose I'll do 6 or 7 or 8 large speaking events around the U.S. I'm going to continue doing my podcast on vegan.com on a weekly basis, and your listeners can subscribe to that through iTunes or type in their email address to vegan.com to get weekly notices when each show is put up. And beyond that, just a lot more writing. I've recently started doing a column for Veg News, which is a superb magazine, which I know that you can subscribe to not just in the U.S. but Canada as well. So, I'll be keeping busy and staying out of trouble. And Rob, thank you so much for having me on the show. It was so great to talk to your audience.
Yeah, well, thanks, Eric. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Take care, and we'll be in touch in the future.
Thank you very much, Rob. I'd love to be back.
All right. You've been listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We were just speaking with activist, author, and podcaster Eric Marcus. You can visit him over at vegan.com. He is the author of a recent book called Meat Market, Animals, Ethics, and Money. And I highly recommend you go and check it out. It's got some great stats. It's an easy read for activists new and not aged, but experienced, I wanted to say. Stay tuned for Roadrunner. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM.